Welcome to Champagne Problems Podcast. I am your host, Robbie Shaw. Join us as we explore mental and emotional well-being, physical optimization, and the journey to discovering your highest self. Champagne Problems is brought to you in proud partnership with Bond Buzz, the alcohol-free social spirit.
Aaron Lazar, welcome to Champagne Problems.
Thanks, man. Happy to be here.
I am honored to be here as well, sitting across from you. I do have a little housekeeping, which I know we already talked about, and that is to recognize the fact that the title of my podcast is a little cheeky compared to the substance of what we're going to talk about today. You know, I've caught a little crap for that at times during this.
I don't think so, man. I like the title.
Good. Good.
We're two, I just learned that I'm a Duke guy, you're a Chapel Hill guy.
Mm-hmm.
We have champagne problems, man.
Yeah, we do. In that space, sure.
You know, we got real problems.
True.
We got some champagne problems.
Good.
Just because you have real problems doesn't mean you can't have champagne problems.
I love it. I'm glad you see it that way.
Yeah.
So again, I am honored to be sitting with you, not just because of what you're doing today, but I do know your resume. I've known of you, and I've known you for a long time. Interestingly, I'm a face guy, not a name guy. I don't remember names, but I remember almost every face I've ever seen. So when I was asked to do this interview, I looked up who Aaron Lazar was. And you
saw
I know this
way
dude.
Too much.
I know this guy.
Okay, all right.
So very happy to be sitting here, excited as to what we're going to talk about. Shout out to the Joe Martin ALS Foundation for asking me to do this.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
You're going to be a part of their event in a few weeks down in Greensboro and Charlotte. I'll give those details later. So thank you. Start with a little rapid fire. Lighten it up.
I love, baby. Love rapid fire. Let's go.
What was your first live music concert and where?
Oh, this is a great story. Yes. I was in seventh grade. And I had a crush on this girl, and she had real champagne problems. Her parents had like a, this is South Jersey. I grew up in South Jersey outside of Philadelphia, a town called Cherry Hill. Her family had like a condo. It was either Atlantic City or Ventnor. So 13 years old, she's like, "Do you want to go to a Bobby Brown concert?"
Mm.
And I was like, mm. I was like, not really, but with you.
Really?
I would go see anybody. So,
not so much.
Cut to somehow mom and dad schedule me to get my braces on that day.
Oh.
And I think I showed up to the orthodontist. There was no room, so they had to put spacers in. And essentially, within like 2 hours of getting these spacers in, I was being picked up by Stacy's mom. And I couldn't feel my mouth. Like, I was in excruciating pain, and I had to pretend that I wasn't, trying to have a good time. We drive an hour down the shore to get to the concert. It starts to pouring, it's just pouring rain, and the concert gets canceled. And Stacy's like, "Do you want to grab some pizza?" And I'm too shy and embarrassed at this point to be like, "I can't feel my mouth.
I can't eat."
Like, right? I should have just told them, or at least had my mom tell her mom, like, Aaron can't chew anything because he can't feel his teeth.
Right.
But I didn't say that. So I suffered through trying to eat a piece of pizza on the boardwalk. And then essentially they drove me home. And I never got to see Bobby Brown.
That's your first live music concert.
Live music concert. Yeah.
That's a phenomenal story. Thank you for sharing that.
What was yours?
Mine was INXS.
Oh, great band.
Yes.
Used to have the tapes, man. I used to take those to camp with me every summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Loved INXS. Sixth grade, Ziggy Marley opened.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Went with a buddy of mine and his older sister and a couple of her friends. It was a big event. Big
That's
event.
That's fantastic.
Charlotte Coliseum.
I think the first concert that I actually made it to, my parents took us to see like the Four Tops and the Temptations and Valley Forge. I remember that. But that was like their music. I grew up on their music mostly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's weird. I don't remember that first concert experience where I'm like, whoa. And I don't remember the first Broadway show that I ever saw, which is super disappointing.
Yeah.
So everybody's like, what's the first Broadway show you saw?
Right. I'm like, I don't know.
I don't really know.
You take the eighth.
I remember, yeah, actually that same girl, man, this girl's making it into this
oh,
podcast.
Oh, Tracy.
That same girl when we were 18, we stopped dating. You know, we dated for a hot second in seventh grade, and then in high school, we fell in love, like real, you know, first girlfriend for real. Mm. And we went to see Tommy on Broadway.
Yeah.
And I only remember that because, you know, I guess I was 18 years old, but I know I've seen a show before that.
Yeah.
I just don't know what it is.
Huh. All right. Well.
Sorry.
It's fine.
I'm very disappointed.
It's fine.
These are champagne.
The story's
problems,
better. This is champagne major problems. Champagne problems. All right. Second question. What's your favorite smell?
Smell? Oh man. It's a great question.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the cliche, like a rose. Mm. It's just a rose. There's some nice roses like on the block that my kids at their elementary school that they used to go to. I would just literally stop and smell the roses.
Mm. I like it. Wildflowers or flowers in general. Yeah. It's a good smell. There's a nostalgia associated.
Yours?
My favorite smell, interestingly, is like salty air.
Oh, I love that.
Just beach.
Yeah.
Crummy marsh. You know, it just gives me the
stinky swamp,
just all of it. It just makes me think of the beach, and that's kind of a happy place.
Cool.
Which actually leads itself to the next question. What location, I said travel location, but just location in general, gives you the most peace?
Oh. Wow. Wow. I mean, I'm just thinking, I mean, the two most beautiful places I've been, I think, are Hawaii. There's a beach in Vieques off of Puerto Rico, and a little island. That's an amazing beach. It's very peaceful. It's very quiet. There's nobody there. It's white sand. And then, like, the mountains of Grindelwald, Switzerland.
Mm.
Just stunningly beautiful.
Hmm. Never been to Switzerland.
But I've learned I got to find peace. Wherever
right
I'm
here.
Like, I mean, I'm serious.
I know.
You have ALS.
Yeah.
You find peace.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're not a happy camper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can see how some of these questions, you know, there's probably not a past life, but a life prior to ALS and then a life post ALS. I mean, you think about things differently.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last one, a little cerebral. If you could have the answer to any question in the world, what would you ask?
Have the answer to any question in the world. I mean, the question right now would just be, what is the thing that is causing my body to do what it's doing? Because mm-hmm. I've asked that question every day for 2 years now. And I found so many answers that I thought were the answer that would unlock physical healing. So it's unlocked healing mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. Has yet to unlock physical healing.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully believe in the body's abilities and capabilities to heal from anything. So that's that question. If somebody could... Can you please answer that for me?
Yeah.
Why Anybody is my out there? Body...
Call in.
Why We've is got my a, body doing this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. It's a big question.
It is.
All right. Well, let's move into some more of the conversation. For our listeners, give us a little, if you would, little bio, little background.
Actors hate talking about themselves, Robbie.
Yeah.
Aaron Lazar.
Accolades.
Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Oldest of three. You know, wonderful sort of middle class, at times upper middle class upbringing. Two of the greatest parents in the world. Mm. Great brother and sister, younger brother and sister. My brother's a dentist in Manhattan. My sister used to work for my dad's construction company, and then just got a great new job at a new company. They both have families with little girls, so I have three nieces. I have two boys, 12 and 14, engaged to an incredible woman who is an executive coach for communication leadership for a big executive coaching company.
Cool.
And yeah, man, I mean, I spent first 18 years of my life in Cherry Hill, started doing musicals in high school, was a track athlete, went to Duke for track, and they gave me a scholarship to help them establish an opera program there, which I realized pretty quickly wasn't my passion. Tried to create a musical theater major, but I was on scholarship for music, so I kind of had to be a good boy, do the music major. Wanted to be a doctor, so I was pre-med, doing all that. Acting teacher, saw a voice recital, cast me as the lead in Carousel. So I played Billy Bigelow in college. And I told myself I wasn't going to do it. I did musicals in high school, and it was amazing, and I loved it. But I was like, I got to focus. I got to be a doctor. But then that was like my dream role. So, of course, you know, the universe threw me like, here's the one part.
Right.
That you can't say no to.
That's going to shift you from
everything
else.
It really did. It did. I mean, these teachers saw something in me. That's kind of a running theme in my life, or at least it was. The teachers saw more in me than, and, you know, guided me, right? They were definitely guides. So to the point where I, you know, when I had a chance to return the favor and become an honorary board member of the Tennessee Arts Academy, which helps teachers, arts teachers, K through 12 in Tennessee and the surrounding states, I was like, I got to do this because teachers changed my life. So, yeah, got into acting in college, went and did an internship, I think the summer of my sophomore, between sophomore and junior year. Made $30 a week at a professional theater, you know, cleaning up after professional actors and being in the ensemble of shows, and saw an opportunity. I was like, I think I could do this if I get some training. But I wasn't really sure how it was going to go. I took the MCATs and I applied to grad school for musical theater, and I figured God would light the path. But I did well in both. So I said to my parents, like, here's the plan.
Got a backup.
I got a backup. Like, right. Can I go to grad school for 2 years for musical theater? The MCATs are good for 3 years. So that'll give me 1 year to move to New York or LA and try and get a job. If it doesn't work, I'll go be a doctor. And they were like, yeah, you can do that. Yeah. They've always been really supportive. So I went to grad school at the Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music in Ohio, Cincinnati for 2 years, moved to New York after that. And within 6 months had my first Broadway tour. And then moved back to my Roach motel of an apartment with a couple college roommates after that tour. And
in Manhattan,
Murray Hill, Manhattan. And then
I used to live right near there.
Whereabouts?
58th between 1st and 2nd.
Okay, this first apartment was 27th between 2nd and 3rd.
A little lower, yeah.
And then that was it. The MCATs expired and I was an actor. And then the last 20 years, here we are.
That's a good story. I love the options. Talk about a champagne problem. Should I be an actor or a doctor? I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
See what pans out. That's great. So what would you say is your most proud accomplishment, achievement in the entertainment space?
I think I have two answers to that. I mean, the one answer would be just my big break was a show called The Light in the Piazza. So I had understudied roles on Broadway up to that point. And then you don't know if you're going to get cast. You know, you don't know if they're only ever going to see you as an understudy or if they're going to give you a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really tough because I didn't want to be a professional Broadway understudy because you're just not able economically to make a real living. That's not the way to put it. You can make a living. It's just hard, and you've got to work all the time because you're not getting paid a lot of money. Even sporting leads on Broadway compared to television film, I mean, it's just a whole different world financially that nobody prepares you for. You just don't understand what it is to be a theater actor and then a working actor in television and film. You just think, oh, I'm going to be a movie star, and that's where all the money is. But that role for me was a big break. I mean, it really showcases what I can do. It was my first opportunity to sort of carry a lead role on Broadway. It was filmed live from Lincoln Center on PBS. It was you know, a critical darling of a show and one of the most beautiful, artful things I've ever done.
Well received?
Yeah, it was incredibly well received. Sort of
cool.
Set the bar incredibly high for my whole career. I was like, oh, this is Broadway, and every show is this artful and beautiful and meaningful and critically acclaimed. They're not. And that was a hard lesson for me to learn, you know, but, yeah, that's probably my most proud, but I've done a lot.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's been really hard. And so I never used to allow myself to be proud of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of my healing journey here with ALS has been, let's look back at the things that I denied my own success a lot.
Mm.
You know, it was just kind of like, yeah, this is fine, but we got to get to here. Mm-hmm. And then now we got to get to here. We got to get to here. And you miss a lot of joy and a lot of love,
yeah,
and a lot of gratitude when you put that amount of pressure on yourself to just keep getting to some future that when I get there, everything's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the trap I fell into just as an actor and a dad and a husband trying to provide the most for my family.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty common theme across many industries and just life experiences. I certainly battle that, and I'm not in that industry. Yeah, every achievement, it's, thank you. Now, what am I going to do with that to get even higher or bigger or better? And I don't sit in that moment.
Yeah, I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
I just don't. I think a big part of my healing was to really realize, I mean, and also, you know, this came from, you know, out of books, right? I've spent the last 2 years reading, I think it's 60 some books now on healing, the nervous system, the mind-body connection, all of it. And when you read psychological root causes of ALS being connected to, you know, low self-worth, denial of one's success, fear of life and the body playing dead, and
you read that?
Oh yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, because that's me going again, that question, like what the, you know, someone give me the answer as to why my body is doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been the lead researcher on my team.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question I'm asking, and I'm sourcing all kinds of opportunity to change. You know, medicine is doing everything it can do.
Yeah.
There are thousands of doctors and researchers and biotech companies and patient caregivers and incredible people doing everything they can do to help people like me with this disease. And in the meantime, well, they figure it out and they do their thing. I got to do my thing. And I'm like, how can I change to help myself heal? And one of the first things I learned is that, you know, health is not just physical. It's mental and emotional and spiritual.
Yep.
So that blew my mind because I was just an athlete, you know, and a amateur wannabe Schwarzenegger idolizing bodybuilder meathead in college, you know. My whole life was physical fitness, and then it was nutrition. And I thought, if I do those two things, I'll never get sick. I'll never have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never do get sick, knock on wood.
Yeah.
But somehow I have ALS, like one of the worst diseases ever.
Right.
Like, so what is that? It's like how did it is a disease of the nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
So just in simple terms, you know, I just think of it as like, well, what are the nerves? They're the wiring that connect the brain to the body. What am I running through the wires?
Uh-huh.
Like what energy am I running through the wires? Neuroscience is like thoughts and feelings are the energy running through the wiring. So I was like, well, if I can change those things, then maybe I can repair the wires.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? That's my take.
Yeah.
And so things like being proud of the things that I do, trying to be in the moment of life and enjoy those things, you know, whether I have a day with you, we get to talk, have a good time, meetings, calls, whatever, or I have a day where I'm sitting 14 hours a day with my kids in a basketball gym, you know, sometimes with 3-4 hours to kill between games, how can I be present in my life and be grateful for my life and enjoy my life despite tremendous adversity?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what I am. I have taught myself to do, and I teach myself to do it every day.
Yeah. Walk us through a little bit of the shitty part of this whole thing, which was the beginning of the process or the The diagnosis.
Yeah, I mean, I was just sitting around almost 3 years ago now. My quads are twitching, and so when I Googled it, it said ALS, and I was like, what? And I was going through a breakup at the time with a woman who's now my fiance, and we'd been together a year already at that point. And so I just thought, this has got to be spiritual or emotional. Like, there's something going on here, you know. Like, I was acutely aware that. Despite, again, I was coming off some pretty big success in my career at that point. I had done a national tour of a Broadway show called Dear Evan Hansen, and then went right mm-hmm. into a series regular on a television show for Fox, a show called Filthy Rich. And that was a dream of mine to be a series regular on a television show, 20 years in the making, right? So despite all of that, I this breakup happened, and I just thought, I feel like I haven't changed. Like, I feel like here we are again. And what do I mean by that? It's just kind of like I had gone through a terrible divorce maybe 4 or 5 years prior, and thought really knocked down. I mean, I got up off the mat and I thought, well, that's the worst thing I'll ever have to go through in my life. So we did that. So doesn't life now owe me all the good stuff? And the good stuff was like work was like great, you mm-hmm. know, and money, thank God, you know, was good for those couple of years, because we were about to hit this pandemic hard. Nobody was going to work. But there was something emotionally and spiritually about what I was going through that just didn't feel right. It felt like I don't want to live like this anymore, like on a much deeper level. I don't want to be in a place where I go through a breakup and I feel completely alone, insecure, scared about work again, just like a pattern. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was enslaved to a pattern, an emotional addiction in my life, if you will, that just, I kept expecting things outside of me to change that. Well, you get the job, it gets better. You get the girl, it gets better. You get the money, it gets better, right? And then, okay, sure. While you have those things, what happens if those things go away?
Yeah, then where are you?
Where are you? And I thought, here we are again. I'm going through a breakup, and I'm unemployed again as an actor. Why does this keep happening? I'm miserable, even though everybody thinks I have a great, amazing life. And it was just me. It was my perception of the world that I had practiced for so long, doing my best to survive an industry that is really, really hard. It is not a meritocracy. It is not fair. There's a tremendous amount of injustice. But instead of allowing that to be a human experience for me, I just kept willing myself through. I mean, there were probably years where I auditioned 200 times and maybe booked one job, you know, dealing with a significant amount of rejection. How do you handle that? Maybe slow down, take a break, but I couldn't, man. I was just like, no, it's going to happen. It'll be the next one. And I mean, to me, that all adds up to nervous system chronic stress. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's chronic stress. So the twitches start, and I go, well, now we're adding a layer of complexity onto my life that's like, do I have a terminal disease that I know people that have died from? Is that now going on? And so my mind broke. I mean, I went through anxiety and insomnia and depression, just trying to hold myself together throughout this whole thing, while being like, no, I just want to get back together with my girlfriend and have everything be happy and good again, right? Like, isn't that... And it would be about 8 months before I actually got the diagnosis. So that period of time was terrible. But every day since has been infinitely better.
Okay.
You know, like that was it. Like the diagnosis was it. The diagnosis was the bottom.
Yeah.
And I thought I had hit bottom before. And it wasn't some poetic existential philosophical Alan Watts bottoming out. I'd been there, where you feel like I'm living in anxiety and insomnia and depression, but I'm in this philosophical spiritual leveling up where, you know, I'm at the bottom of the ocean, and even though, you know, one perception of it is I'm drowning, the other perception is, wait a second, I'm at the bottom of the ocean. Isn't it beautiful down here? It wasn't like that. I found that with my divorce.
Mm-hmm.
This was real.
Mm.
This was like, okay, I do not want to spend a single second of whatever life I have left feeling the way I have felt for even who knows how long. At that point, I hadn't investigated myself. I was just about to become aware that there was work to do here. But I knew very quickly fear had to go.
Mm.
Like fear just had to go. So that's where it started. And that's where I started to change.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Where in the world do I want to go? I've got so many ideas.
Yeah, man.
Man, thank you for sharing that. I mean, obviously it's, you know, I mean, you're living most of our greatest fears, which is finding out you've got something terminal, or knowing, or at least being told that there's an end coming soon.
Well, told by who?
Totally. And let's go there for sure.
Because, you know, I don't say but, I say yes and, right? It's like living everybody, most people's greatest fears. Yeah. I mean, I spoke at a conference of neurosurgeons, and one of them thought it would be a good idea to tell me afterwards, you know, the disease most neurosurgeons fear their patients getting the most is ALS. And you know, the disease most neurosurgeons fear getting themselves the most is ALS, or neurologists or something. And I was like, yeah, that doesn't help me for you to tell me that.
Appreciate it.
Like,
yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Dinner.
But it's true. So there is a box here, okay, of ALS.
Mm-hmm.
And let's call it 3D ALS.
Okay.
And it's, here's your diagnosis. Get your affairs in order. We don't know how long.
Right.
Some people, it's quick. You don't have fast. Yours is slow moving. Slow moving, we have no idea. Good luck, you know, for lack of a better, you know, and that
no known cure that
oversimplifies, right? Like, no known cure. Here's some medicines, you know, unfortunately, one of which didn't pass a phase 3 thing recently. And so people with ALS are now kind of like, well, should we even keep taking it? And some doctors say yes, and some say no. A lot of drug trials, which is great. A lot of research being done, tremendous amount of biotech research, tremendous amount of funding now coming into it, though there could always be more. Incredible. I stand on the shoulders of Brian Wallach and his wife, Sandra, who raised $1 billion federally with IAM-ALS. You know, Dan Doktoroff and his work to raise $250 million. There are incredible people out there doing incredible things. But can I go home and take something that will help me? Not yet, you know. And I take a lot of things supplement wise, right, to try and give my cells as much help. It's because we don't know what this is. We don't know why the cells are not why are the motor neurons dying? It's counter to life.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they doing that? So anyway, there's that box of ALS, right? And there's all the terrible in that box. I don't need to tell you guys what the terrible is. It's terrible,
yeah.
Right? But then there is the ability to not live in the box. And that's what I've trained myself to do for 2 years. And that's then being outside of the box and knowing that, like, my body is dealing with it, but I am not my body. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so doing that takes a lot of, for me, it's taken a lot of practice. It's a daily practice.
So for the people that this disease is touching, what are those practices and what do they look like?
Yeah, I mean, I again, my story is, one of the things I've learned about ALS is it's different for everybody. I mean, it's just different. and different on every level. Even though it seems like it's just this thing, it's kind of not. It moves differently in everybody, in different parts of their body, at different speeds, different times. The end result can unfortunately be the same, but the journey there is not. So my journey is, I don't pretend that it's something that is like a prescription for anyone else, but I do believe there are parts of it that are universal. And I think the interest in the question, how did I get this?
Yeah.
Is a good question to begin. Because for me, that opened a whole world of more questions and answers to those questions and an examination of my life with looking for my relationship to my body. You know, why are these motor neurons doing this? So instead of being like, well, they're doing it and I guess I'm gonna die.
Yeah.
I was like, how do I get them to stop doing it?
No.
They're mine. Why are they doing it? And I thought, well, maybe I'm sending the wrong message, you know? And there's so much research that I uncovered for myself that made so much sense to me. There's a chapter of Gabor Mate, if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, forgive me, a chapter of his book on ALS where he talks about how nice people are. And from Stephen Hawking and Lou Gehrig to a woman who reverses ALS simply by starting to love herself. Mm. And so I was looking for clues anywhere. What does it mean to love yourself? I mean, dude, we could spend an entire hour just talking about that.
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Mm-hmm. It's different for everybody.
Different for everybody. And I have spent, you know, it was a solid first year before a huge heart-opening breakthrough with regards to self-love and self-worth. And so the process for me has been this heart-opening, eye-opening, spirit-elevating, consciousness-elevating experience of knowing myself and looking at how I used to live my life versus how I live it now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that it really answers your question.
No.
There's so much to talk about.
I know. And it's so deep.
Excuse me.
And it's so individual. And I get it. And I, you know, I mean, the only, as I sit here with you and feel your vibe and energy and listen to you, you know, the only natural way for me to respond is to try to relate in some way. And I know I can't equally, but in my own space, you know, there are events in my life that have changed me and have changed how I perceive the world as well as myself. And then, you know, there's wisdom associated with that that we try to instill on others and say, hey, you don't have to go through all this hell to get to this place of how you're living right now, how I live in my own way, you know. And I think that is, it sounds like that is so much of your mission, is to try to speak to people and say, you know, it doesn't have to, I'm living my life this way now, and I wish I did before.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I get to teach my kids and share with my fiance whatever secrets I've learned, you know, like you're saying, it does become what feels like wisdom. And for me, you know, it's like, it's belief. You know, it's belief. I really believe in this idea that you can only manifest that which you're willing to accept and believe.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't accept it or believe it, maybe you can get lucky, but you know, like
maybe
my
it'll just happen.
My kid's like, I want to be in the NBA, and I'm like, well, you got a better shot of getting there if you. He was like sad, you know, a couple months ago. He's like, Dad, what if you don't beat ALS? And I was like, well, you want to be in the NBA. Do you have a better shot of getting there if you believe you can get there or if you don't? I don't have a chance of beating ALS unless I believe I can beat ALS. Now, getting past, you know, collective consciousness and that box of what ALS what ALS is to most of the world, I can't live in that box and then have my dream.
Yeah. No.
So
right.
Then why would I live in that box? Why would I spend my life terrified and afraid and angry and sad and all these things? And don't get me wrong, there are plenty of those days.
Sure.
You know, plenty of days screaming in anger and crying and, you know, I don't know how to keep going while my body does whatever it's doing. And then there's, well, how do you do it? You just do it. Because that's my dream. That's my mission. You know, I'm so connected to this mission of being the 61st reversal, being somebody who can get out there and share with the world. I did it. Here's how I did it. Here's what I learned. And in the meantime, it's like, okay, well, we're doing it right now while I do it.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't have a crystal ball. Nobody does, right? Yeah. If I don't get there, I don't get there. But I'm connected to the mission enough. And I really believe I'm going to get there. It's not up to me how or when. And so I spend as little time as possible focusing on the, oh, my finger doesn't work, this box of ALS. And I just stay connected to the mission, right, which drives me, which is to share my story in a way that's not only healing for me, but healing for other people and impactful for other people and inspiring, hopefully, for other people. And it's also to continue to peel back the layers on life and understand more and more how I'm not who I thought I was. I thought I was a body and a mind doing a thing. Now I'm like, I am a spirit in this thing. And this thing can lead you, it can work for you or against you. And it worked against me for so long, dude, like 10 years. Yeah.
And masked just, as working for you.
Yeah, and I right? was like, oh, this is my identity. And then, you know, the ALS is like, okay, you've lost your marriage, you've lost, you know, your jobs before. Like, you've had identity losses there. We're going to take your body away now. Who are you?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's really fucking hard, man.
Yeah.
It's really hard. But I have learned I'm not the body. There's something else. I'm something else. I need this. Like, sure. I need it.
Sure.
I'm not ready to go. I'm not ready to move on. I'm not ready to die. I'm not ready to reincarnate in another body. Like, I want this one because I got a lot to do and I'm uniquely qualified actually to do it, I think, you know, as a storyteller. So I'm, you know, I try and deeply connect to this as it's going through this thing. I don't even remember your question.
No, I mean, I don't either. Wow, man, there's just this like the visual of the box and the outside the box, and then this like, you know, what is the, if there were some answer out there or solution or cure or whatever you want to call it, or reversal, what is it? And it's like, it's not in the box. We know that. And so this belief, maybe that's it.
I mean, and yet it could be there, you know, of the 60 reversals there is, you know, I spoke to, a guy named McFinn Levere, and he's an incredible guy. I think he's in his 70s now. He was really unable to move most of his body. I think he had a couple fingers in his eyes and he was ready to euthanize. If you read his book, I mean, he was done. Miraculous, complete reversal, hiking mountains, you know.
He
had group healings with friends and I believe he had like a Central American shaman or a healer come. I mean, you know, you explore anything and everything. The shaman has since passed away. I've already looked into trying to find that guy. But my point is just that you don't, I'm not here to say if you're living in that box, you're a dead person. Miracles can happen to you, to me, to you, to anybody, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to help unlock those miracles in whatever way feels better to me. When I live in that box, I feel terrible.
Yeah.
It feels hopeless and bleak and sad and, you know, very, very 3D human experience. There's something outside of that that is, it allows me to go through this with whatever grace I'm being blessed with.
Well, aside from a miracle happening in that box, it seems that to be in that place mentally, neurologically, would be a detriment.
Exactly. To me, that box is how I used to live.
Which may
all
have
of
led
my
to
champagne
this.
Problems
right.
were life and death problems, man.
Right.
You know, it's like I had a big callback this morning for a television show, and there was all this stress trying to get the room set up and the thing, and my fiance was stressed, and I got on the call and some of the people on the Zoom seemed stressed. I'm not stressed, man. That is champagne problem stuff, and that's okay because they can't possibly understand what I'm going through. I completely understand what they're going through, and I'm not saying my problems are better than yours.
Right.
I'm just saying this kind of shit puts life in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I really have come to learn that perspective plus the event, right? Energy plus consciousness equals the creation of your reality. And if I can change the energy and I can change the level of consciousness with which I'm looking at my life, if I can take whatever the event is, this conversation, and I can put it in a perspective that allows me to have an experience that I want, then I have a much better shot of having that experience be the reality. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds really maybe simple, you know, and as with most things in life, simple is not easy. It takes practice. But I have come to believe that it's not just, I believe I can beat ALS or I will heal from ALS. It's I believe that I am a conscious co-creator of my life, of my reality. We used to do it as kids, man. I mean, how did you end up playing basketball at UNC?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You had a dream. You went for it. You were living it. You weren't overthinking it. You were doing your thing. God and the universe gave you whatever. Well, you did it. We become adults and all kinds of stuff gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And we practice patterns that take us away from an ease and a flow and a connection to co-creating our lives. And then we think, oh, we can't do that. No, we can't do that anymore. That's not how life works. Life works in that box.
Mm-hmm.
You get this diagnosis, you get that. Well, I mean, I'm reading a book called Cured by Dr. Jeffrey Redinger. And it's about, he studied spontaneous remissions for 17 years. People cure themselves of all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Miracles happen in all kinds of ways. So I'm here trying to also share that message, which is like, please do not pity me. Spend time imagining me 100%, imagining that the miracle has already happened, and fill that vision of me with all your love and your magic. And I'll do the same for you. And that's how we can help each other. Because what other choice do we have? Why do it any other way?
Mm-hmm. Simple.
Sure. Sure. Exactly.
It's so simple. Keep it simple, stupid.
My grandmother said, keep it sweet and simple. The kiss method.
Yep. Hmm. Well, the golly, man, the inspiration. I mean, that's what you're giving in so many different ways. And of course, there's this. Yeah, it applies to the people that are going through similar to what your experience is. But then there's these people like me, or whomever else that are just listening to this, and just are being impacted. And there's more going on here than ALS. There's an energy, there's a vibe, I mean it's making me emotional.
Yeah,
it's powerful, man.
Me too, man. Yeah. And the emotion is right there, you know. I mean, it's right there. And I appreciate you saying that.
Well, what do you want to talk about now?
Well, I'd love to tell you how I painted this. So
yeah, I appreciate you bringing that in.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to say the quote, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard you sing it. And it's that's it, man.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I'll add is, you know, heaven and hell seem to be within. They seem to be states of mind, you know, and if you can change your perception, I could spend most of my day in hell just paying attention to, you know, having a certain perception of whatever it is that I'm dealing with. And my I have, you know, some dear friends dealing with significant cancer diagnoses, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, 8 years in. That's pain. That to me is, that is hell. Mm. That is pain. There are people dealing with extraordinary pain. Thankfully, ALS is not, it's uncomfortable, but it's not painful. So it gives me an opportunity to do something that people with cancer have that much harder of a time. If you're in pain, sometimes you can just barely do whatever you can do to get through the day.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm in pain, it's because I am causing my own suffering around whatever it is that I am loss of function on this day, a focus on why I can't do this thing. I am resisting, you know, whatever it is that is coming my way that day. Well, I used to live that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying just not to do that. And I believe that in the reprogramming of that, of reprogramming my nervous system, reprogramming my mind-body connection, saying to myself and the world and God, universe, whatever you want to call it, there's another way to do it. Maybe there's a different way to do it. In doing that, I at least open myself up to possibilities that might not otherwise be possible.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can do it, I think, if not everybody, a lot of people can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully that's part of what my message is, you know. Yeah.
Thanks, dude.
Thanks, man. Such a pleasure.
Amazing. I'm just going to say real quickly, hello. Aaron Lazar will be in Greensboro and Charlotte.
Yeah, please come. Greensboro and Charlotte.
For the Joe Martin ALS Foundation events. Don't
April
miss him.
17, 18.
17th and 18th.
Yep.
That's right. 17th Greensboro, 18th Charlotte. Thank you for all you're doing, man. I don't know how else to end it other than thank you.
Well, it's a shared experience, man. Thank you. Thanks for everything you're doing.
All right, brother.
Thanks, man.
Cool. Sweet, dude. Thank you, man.
Yeah, thank you.
That was real.
That was real.
What the fuck else are we doing here, right?
That's right.